are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, I'm Erin Fairbanks, and this is a special report for the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. We are in studio with Matthew Stillman, and we are going to talk a little bit of shop, looking at food media today. Matt, let's give our listeners a sense of, you know, kind of who you are and why we should care about you. Now, you spent a lot of time back in the late 90s really starting to launch or maybe relaunch the Food Network. So maybe you can give us a sense of what was going on and what your role was during that time.
Well, I was really fortunate when I got out of college in 96. My first job was working at the Food Network, which was at that point in time a small network of about 10 million people who could even see it. And I worked there from 96 to 2000. And when I left, I was director of program development there. And I was very fortunate to be at the network in this sort of explosive time when it really was trying to change itself from a dump and stir type of programming to more entertainment. And I really had my hand in the center of that, of seeing, A, the decisions being made, but I helped develop many shows and find hundreds of talent. But I helped develop Iron Chef and Good Eats. Those are the two sort of signature shows, which are still, in many ways, strong points for the network, even a decade later.
So I'm curious, you know, what the landscape of food television was like back in 96. I think we take for granted today, there's these kind of juggernauts, the Food Network, the Cooking Channel, and it seems like everyone's got their finger in some type of pot of food programming. What was happening in the late 90s? I mean, what was your competition and what was the landscape at the time?
The only competition really was PBS in terms of television programming. Their only real understanding of what a food show could be was you make stuff or you go somewhere to make stuff. Maybe in the process of going to learn to make stuff, you'd see like, oh, this countryside is lovely. Oh, Tuscany's amazing. But that was, it was basically PBS, but there was sort of this larger thought that, you know, there is a whole world of food beyond just cooking, but let's start there and let's see where it goes. But there wasn't any sort of initiative to go beyond that, beyond the thought of we could, but we don't know how to get there. So that's where it started.
And you say dump and stir. What does that mean?
Well, you know, so you sort of see with most older cooking shows, even with Julia Child, who's fantastic, but most of, you think of any cooking shows you might have seen from your youth, unless you're particularly young, people sort of stand in front of a essentially a fake-looking cooktop, have a pot, you know, it's probably a lovely Le Creuset something or a, you know, cast-iron old-time thing, and just dump food in and talk about stuff as they stir it with their right hand or their left hand. And it basically is a pure observational cooking technique sort of thing. There's no story per se. There's no real entertainment value per se, unless the personality happens to be entertaining. So it's just functionally dumping and stirring process.
And it is cooking. I mean, let me rephrase, I guess. I'm kind of trying to think of like what category we would put that type of programming in. I mean, is it educational? Is it reality TV? Is it, you know, it's not, doesn't seem to have, it has some entertainment value, but also there's this aspect of instruction. And
I'd say it's instruction / educational, with a, it's sort of like almost slightly functional Muzak. I mean, lots of people, I remember very clearly seeing reports and focus groups of people saying, I just sort of watch it to relax. It's just sort of nice to watch experts do their thing. If you, and PBS specializes in this. You may not ever make a bench with, you know, mortise and tendon joints, but it's really sort of relaxing to watch an expert just know what they do and tell you a little bit about it. And wow, new like, Yankee Workshop, amazing.
You're like, chill out with your glass.
Chill
of
out
wine.
With your glass. Well, that's exactly what happens. People would watch it, and it was sort of like a, you could have it in the background. You don't need to watch it constantly, but it's just sort of there. And I'm interested in food, so it's great.
So you're a recent college grad back in 96 and jumping into this kind of existing network. And was there a real energy when you came on the scene of like, hey, we want to shake things up, we want to do something different, and we can't wait to hear all your awesome ideas. Matt, tell us what to do. Well, or
there was a little bit of that. I mean, it was so young. It was, for someone who was really my first job to even have access to the network president or the program and development president to say, I have ideas. Because, I did TV when I was in college. That wasn't what I got my degree in, but I thought, I've got lots of ideas. I'd love to make this good. So there was space for that. I think if you came into the Food Network now, or if you came to any network now that is a big established network, it's really hard to find a place to put your foot down, and the whole distribution channels are differently. So to get to the network when it was, at 10, 12, 13 million people was incredible to be there really at the ground floor.
So how did decisions get made with regards to programming? I mean, do you kind of sit around a table and you pitch ideas and you go through workshopping things out, or what's the process?
There was sort of a glorious mess in the old days. I mean, there certainly was a programming structure where people sat around and had meetings. But because it was so small and everyone sort of had access to everyone, you could sort of have lots of informal meetings. There was not an unlimited budget, but there were lots of sort of channels you could find to do experiments. Like, oh, I think this person's sort of interesting. I'll put them on for 5 episodes of Ready, Set, Cook and see if they're good on television. Oh, maybe they're good there. I'll, talk to the, person who's producing Chef du Jour and say, oh, Pat, can you put this person on for 5 episodes? Oh, well, what was their tape like on Ready, Set, Cook? And fine. And then suddenly someone's done 10 episodes of something. And it's like, well, could I develop a show around them? Maybe. Let's do 10. It was pretty free-flowing. And then as the network started to develop even more from 96 to 98, that started to get more formal. And by that time, I had moved into a formal development position. I had many other positions in those 2 years in production and having in touch with development, but I finally had actually sat and had a development position officially, and now I was working on that full-time as we started to get more seasoned executives. Not to say the people who came in weren't seasoned, but the network started to get a little bit of a growth spurt. Emeril really started to take off, and he started to be the tip of the spear for, we can make new types of programming.
Sure, and I think now there's like this very obvious culture of celebrity chefs, and for kind of up-and-coming young chefs, folks who are starting in their first restaurant, it seems like if you look at kind of your menu of career options, you can hang tight and run your little restaurant, you can look at building more restaurants, you can look at developing, more of a media personality and taking that into, a TV show or series, and I'm curious, like, back when the network was kind of getting going, were the TV personalities also restaurateurs, or was that a separate thing?
There absolutely were people who were who saw that this was going to be the next wave and saw that if you could be successful on television, that it would incredibly help your career and your restaurants. And your restaurants are really where your moneymaker was. I mean, this was a cable budget, still are small. I mean, they're obviously bigger now than they were, but you weren't making big bucks for making the television show, but you'd make big bucks from the books you'd sell, from the more people who'd come to your restaurant, from the notoriety, et cetera. So there absolutely were people who were hip to that and who could take a certain level of skill or capability or confidence in front of the camera and just say, I'm going to go with this. And so not to say that someone like Bobby Flay wouldn't have been successful anyway. He's an incredibly talented chef and well accoladed for all good reasons. But, he's pretty good on TV, and so he could make his stamp even bigger.
What do you think makes someone good on TV? What are those qualities?
I think the ability to look beyond the camera and have a feeling like you're connecting with people, the capacity to tell stories, and to be able to get off track and then find your way back. There's plenty of people who sort of seize up, and even though they may be sort of quote unquote themselves and saying the things that they say or do the things that they do, they may need a lot of, when you're bowling and there are those little bumper things. That, mm-hmm. I think a lot of people who are on TV when they're new sort of like, well, where am I trying to get to? And let's travel that sort of narrow path. I think people who are best on TV are really comfortable wandering into the second, third, and fourth lanes and say, oh, I'll get to those pins when I get to them. Whenever that mark happens to be. And so some people who I think are best on TV just feel unafraid to be themselves, not necessarily to be crazy, but just to be able to wander.
So let's talk about Iron Chef. Where did that idea come from?
Well, you know, I watched it when I was in high school and college on international channels. So, you know, I'm born and bred New Yorker. I used to watch it on international channels on early cable. I don't even remember what channel it was on, and thought it was just wonderful spectacle. It was all in Japanese. I had no idea what was going on, but I would watch it regularly. And same thing in college. I watched it on this international channel, and I just thought, I just love this show. I was raised watching Kung Fu movies on Saturday mornings on Channel 5 here in New York, and just it appealed to lots of my sort of over-the-top, dramatic Asian sensibility stuff, which I had appreciated from a theatrical point of view. And so when I came to the Food Network, I sort of had that in my pocket and think, this would really be a great show if you could dub it and make it look like a Kung Fu movie. And so that was really, you know, within, I don't know, 4 or 5 months that I had been at the network, and I sort of started to feel a bit like I have a place here, I have some ideas about this, and this isn't just a job. I'm actually found myself interested in the subject matter a lot. I started pitching it. I got a tape and showed it to Joe Langan, who is the vice president of production at the time, and said, I think we should do this. We should, you know, somehow get this show and do it and dub it. And he was like, this is bizarre and crazy. And this, how does this match up with what we're doing? This doesn't, you know, look like Michelle Urvater. This doesn't look like Emerald. This doesn't look like David Rosengarten. All the people who were on the network at the time, or Sarah Moulton, any number of people. And I said, you know, but we could make, you know, there's a whole world of, you know, sort of more fun, more aggressive, more thoughtful, more playful types of programs that we could make. And I think this could be an amazing signature. And he's like, great initiative, kid, but, you know, go back to emptying buckets underneath the sink of Ready, Set, Cook, which I was doing at the time. So just as a quick aside about emptying buckets, Ready, Set, Cook was produced in the studio with no running water. So we used sinks which had no pipes to them. So you had to constantly take the buckets underneath the sink while the show is running and empty them out so you didn't get floods on stage. So one of my first job was emptying buckets underneath the sink.
I think those positions are probably still available for anyone out there looking to kind of make their entry to TV. I'm sure,
hopefully. I mean, I pray that, of course, Ready, Set, Cook isn't produced anymore, but there are always jobs at the bottom, always jobs at the bottom. So yeah, I mean, he just said, you know, great initiative, but thanks, but no thanks. But I was undeterred. I was, you know, really young. I think I was 22, 23, whatever it was. And just sort of kept it on. And so I would show it to someone else. And I showed it to the president, Erica Grew. And I showed it to another producer saying, you know, Marilyn O'Reilly saying, I think we should really do this. This would be really great. And everyone was like, no, this is really strange. But I sort of didn't forget about it. And I kept on looking for new types of shows and was reading trades and looking for obscure references. And finally, in late 97, early 98, there was a programming switch. And some people got pushed out and some people got brought on. And Eileen Opetut was a new executive who was the SVP of programming and had a background in sort of more entertainment programming. And because I'd shown sort of an interest in development, I sort of got to become her assistant. But because there was really only now a staff of two, I was both her assistant and also actually had, in some ways, more power beyond my position because it was really just two of us. And when I showed her this show, she's like, how did you find this? And I told her the story and said that we could do this. She's like, this is really weird, but maybe we should see what you can find out. And I suddenly was thrown into, you know, I'd never had any experience negotiating with, you know, a foreign company or anything really, but she's like, she threw me into the deep end and said, start to figure out what needs to happen to make this happen, if it could even come to play. And just started the process and got in, and we finally went along, and there's lots of negotiations that went forward and backward and successful and not successful. But in the end, when we finally got to the point where it was getting close, Eileen said, look, I have no idea. This could be too strange for our audience. And if it works, great, it's on you. And if it doesn't, it's totally on you. Like, you've really pushed this forward. She said, I understand why it could be successful, and I hope it is. And at the same time, we're developing other shows. This was in 98, mid-98. There was a rebranding of the network. There's really to make a primetime programming slot that was more about entertainment than just about jumping and stirring.
So I'm trying to imagine, you know, it's about 15 years ago and you're looking to kind of connect with the original producers of Iron Chef. I mean, are you kind of Googling and calling Japan like, hey?
Well, you have to remember the internet was kind of new then.
Yeah. So that I'm like, how did that even work? I mean, how did, you know, do you speak Japanese?
I don't speak Japanese at all. You know, Fuji TV is a big international company, and I reached out to their American sales affiliates who had an office on Fifth Avenue, and all of them spoke English and said, you know, I'm from the Food Network, and, you know, just started the, if you're, a moderately smart person who's decently smart at research, you find a way. I mean, it's not like there was nothing on the internet. There was plenty on the internet. It just was new. So I definitely used it every day. But it wasn't the sort of deep research. I don't even know that Google existed yet. I think we might have actually still been using Alta Vista.
Food Network predated Google. I think you heard it here on the Heritage Radio.
That's for sure. News breaking.
So, all right. So then you were on it. You kind of set this up, and then the show debuted. And what was the response?
It was a hit out of the box. I mean, a huge, crazy hit. There were freak show weirdos, young and old. They were just shocked that suddenly there was a demographic who had never watched the network at all was suddenly watching the network, and they were watching two shows, and they were watching Good Eats, and they were watching Food Network, and Good Eats was the other show which I really helped to develop and sort of have it come to pass. But these two shows were really paired together as outside the standard that which we had made, and even some of the other newer shows which we did, which were perfectly fine, weren't sort of as strange compared to what the network had been as those two. And suddenly we had young people and young men watching the show, watching the network in a way that they just hadn't before.
So for folks who've never seen the kind of Americanized version of Iron Chef, what did it look like when it debuted? I mean, if I sat down with my bowl of popcorn, what was I watching?
You were watching it looked like a dated show in the sense that it was slightly grainy. It wasn't really high definition of four Japanese chefs dressed in sort of overly regal, slightly costumized chef wear, with a chairman. The conceit of the show is there's a chairman who lives in a castle who has four iron chefs of indisputable iron cooking ability to cook for him in competition against the world's greatest chefs. And so the chairman, Kaga, who sort of wears a sort of a combination of a cape tuxedo situation, sort of dramatically chomps into a yellow pepper and asks his these competitors to choose which Iron Chef they want to fight. And sort of, if you've ever seen a kung fu movie, if you've ever seen a samurai film, it has all sort of the solemn, serious, you know, regalness of we take this absolutely seriously. And they did, actually. And even though the show was a little bit camp and a little bit over the top, all the people who were participating took it very seriously. That the results were actually front page news. And there's a real food culture in Japan, even greater than there is now in Brooklyn today. That people kind of shocking. Can you believe it? There's something, yeah.
Outside of Brooklyn.
Is there a place outside of Brooklyn that's into food? Weird. But and then they'd have an hour long battle where they need to make multiple dishes with a surprise ingredient. And Kaga was subtitled, so you'd hear his sort of, you know, fantastic, like, that's my amazing Japanese. And then...
apologies to any actual Japanese
I know, that
speakers.
Was terrible. but it's sort of like that great sort of crisp sounds. Mm-hmm. And then everyone else was subtitled. So you'd have these, girlish sounds for people who were judges. And there was a whole cast of characters all to their own. And so that was sort of combined the two best aspects, I felt, of kung fu movies, which were the subtitling, the bad subtitling, and the overdubs. So,
And it seems like a lot of humor. I mean, I'm kind of like thinking of, you know, like Mystery Science Theater. There's like, there's an affect that's being overlaid on the actual program.
Yeah, there is, but in, it was less trying to like make jokes about it. It was more that we take this seriously and that's the joke.
Okay.
So there wasn't, some of the commentators wouldn't say like, man, can you believe that guy in the red getup? That's crazy. It was more like, wow, he's doing an incredible, like, look what he's doing with the octopus as it's fighting back. This is, octopus is alive. Can you believe it? He's going to, you know, cook, he's actually going to try to cook octopus raw and, you know, as opposed to whatever.
So I know that you left the network in 2000, but Iron Chef has continued in your stead. So maybe can you talk a little bit about, you know, share some of your thoughts on the trajectory over the, you know, next decade and like where it is today, and you know, did you envision it being kind of this ongoing chunk of the network, or are you surprised by that? Or
I'm not surprised by it. I mean, I felt like the original Japanese version was capturing lightning in a bottle, and I thought it was really, in some ways, very perfect. I totally understand the inclination to try to make an American version of it, but I think the American version of it isn't as good as the Japanese version. I think it sort of smooths out some of the eccentricities of the show, which I think makes it charming. And while I think Alton Brown does an amazing job of essentially playing two parts of both announcer and food commentator, I think sort of the cast of characters in the Japanese version for me is more endearing. And I think that, again, it's sort of, if you see the larger landscape of the way reality / entertainment programming has gone in the last 5 years, of course there's been a competition to become the next one. Of course there's been a way to stretch this out of, you know, having redemption battles. I just think that in some ways the food culture of the United States doesn't have the same depth to have the capacity of respect that the Japanese version does, and I think that's what makes the show so fun. And I think that the American show is less fun. Not bad, just less fun.
Okay.
It's not as wild. And that's, of course, part of the American zeitgeist with television shows is we want it to seem wild, but it actually is quite controlled. So if you look at a show like Jersey Shore, which is a terrible show.
Last season, guys.
I know.
Hard to say goodbye.
I know. Cries. Serious cries. But it seems like it's wild, but we know it's a very controlled space. Whereas the Japanese show looks wild, and it is wild. It really feels that way. And so there's, I think, that conceit of American television, but in some ways it's the larger thing of American culture, that we like wildness, but we actually like control, comes out in the show.
We are in studio with Matt Stillman, who was a director of program development for the Food Network back in the late 90s. And we are going to move to a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit about the other show you were instrumental in launching, Good Eat. So hang tight.
Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today.
You're listening to Awake by Jerome LOL on heritageradionetwork.org.
All right, we are back. You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network, and I'm sitting down with Matt Stillman, and we are talking Food Network, back in the emerging days of the network, and we were talking in the last segment about Iron Chef, one of the shows you helped bring to the network, and then I wanted to tuck into Good Eats, another show that you were instrumental in launching. So can you tell us a little bit about that process, and maybe we'll just start by saying what the show actually was for those who've never watched.
Sure. The show Good Eats is, at the time, or the show isn't in production anymore, but it's Alton Brown is still a mainstay of the Food Network. It's a show that was hosted by Alton Brown. It was produced at the time by a company called Mean Street Productions out of Atlanta. And it is a show, if you haven't seen it, which is really looks at one particular ingredient or one particular sort of classic dish and sort of unpacks it from a historical perspective, from an anthropological perspective, from a multiple ingredient perspective and technique perspective. But even more than that, it sort of does it in a very quirky whiz-bang way with a whole sort of own universe of weird characters and Alton Brown sort of talking with secret spies to tell him secrets about the food, to cameras that are based inside the pan, to cameras that are based inside the refrigerators. And he goes to sort of interesting places and sort of has this sort of whiz-bang sort of approach and also a very scientific approach to breaking down what is going on with the process of cooking.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that we see a lot of these days with the rise of the molecular gastronomy movement.
Mm-hmm,
and here on the network, you know, our host Dave Arnold on Cooking Issues tucks into that every week. But I think that was not really on the landscape back in the late 90s.
It did not at all. And so if you wanted to understand what was going on with polymerization of your cast iron pan when you're seasoning it, Alton would show you using tinker toys and little men sitting in buses of what it's like to fill in all the valence shells. And suddenly people would be interested, like, oh, wow, I'm talking about valence shells and cooking, and suddenly feel like, oh, I'm smart. And one of the things that I loved most about that show is that it assumed that the audiences were smart and interested, where so many of the Dump and Stir programs assumed that you knew nothing. And that's one of the things that I, again, loved about Iron Chef, is it just assumed, wow, you can totally follow us if we're going to make the most wackadoo out there stuff or talk about really broad intellectual things.
So how was the kind of pitch process for Good Eats different, or how was it received differently than Iron Chef?
Well, so this was sort of a very fortunate accident, I think, in some ways. I was reading a trade magazine, I forget which one it was, and there was a tiny little mention in this particular article that was talking about a new type of film that Kodak was making. And Kodak, in this article, said the only place this particular piece of new type of film was being used was on an experimental cooking show called Good Eats that was being made in Atlanta. And that was really all it said. And being a development person, your job is sort of like, that sounds interesting. Like, why is a new cooking show using a new type of film? Like, that seems really like, maybe these people are weird and interesting. So I just sort of chased that down and found out who that was. And so at the time that I found out that this was Mean Street in Atlanta, it was sort of fortuitous that I had called them, because they were actually in discussions with CNN to sort of turn this. They'd produced two episodes of the show, which had aired in on a public television station in Chicago once. And they were sort of talking about turning that into somehow to a CNN show. I don't know if that was going to be collapsed, or I don't really know how that was going to work. But they were already at some length, and they were had been trying to get to Food Network, but didn't know where to go. And I think there was sort of, like happens to a lot of these things, I think it was coming in both directions. They were trying to find their way to Food Network, and I was trying to find them. And I don't know if it was the exact day, but it was all sort of coming to pass. And so it worked out pretty fast. So when I reached out to them and said, I've read about this, and tell me what happened. And they sent it to me, and the show was just unlike anything else that we had seen. It was in some ways like my wish fulfilled, because I suddenly I had been pushing for funnier, weirder, smarter shows in this new development process for the shows, for the network to relaunch in 98. And this was just like perfect. It was like this little perfectly formed gem. And it was still raw, but it was just so sharp and so smart. And Alton was just both a natural and a practiced person at being in front of the camera in the way that I was talking about before, that he really could wander off and make something interesting in his wandering and then come back to his point. And it was really just excellent on television. And it really went pretty fast from there. And so a matter of weeks, maybe possibly up to 2 or 3 months, but it was pretty fast that he had a deal and Mean Street was in, and we were going to make a show. And for the first 4, maybe 5 seasons, I don't recall exactly, Alton would produce these incredible things, and I would work with him to reshape the scripts. And so we'd come up with topics. We would, Alton definitely did 90% of the writing, because it really was his baby. But I was in some ways the bumpers for him to say, here's the way we can move this, here's the way we can deepen this, here's the way we can make more characters. And I think my own impact on Good Eats was to allow Alton the comfort to say, we can get weirder and we can be smarter. And he was already willing to be weird and smart. So I think I definitely helped him develop the multiple characters, the comic lines, to really go for laughs as opposed to just purely information. And I think that definitely filled out the show to make it feel more like, oh, I can definitely live in this space as opposed to just be informed or even just entertained by this space.
So you're a recent college grad, you know, working for an emerging kind of TV network. You've brought in a couple of shows. Things are going well. But then in 2000, you left. What happened?
I got fired. I got totally fired. So a couple things happened. The first thing is that the network was purchased by a new company. And yeah, so when I left, I was made to leave. I didn't think enough of this, because I was loving it. It was an amazing job. I mean, I'll tell you how I got fired in a second. But I mean, my job was to meet chefs, eat at restaurants, find stories about food and see if they could be turned into a television show, and then oversee the production of those shows and made sure that they stayed fun and smart. It was a pretty amazing job. And I loved it. But this actually in some ways feeds into why I got fired. It was my first job out of college, and I had been really successful in it. And these two shows, but there were others that I worked on, were all doing very well. And at one point in one of the all company meetings, the new president of the network, who had just been brought in by the new parent company, Scripps, actually said in front of everyone, Matthew Stillman is the future of this network. You know, these two shows are like absolute rating anchors for us, and Matthew Stillman is the golden boy of Food Network. And I was like, I am amazing, guys. Seriously, I'm amazing.
You're like, I got this.
I got this.
Clap, clap.
Seriously. And I wouldn't say I'm an amazingly arrogant person, but I think that developed a type of, fostered a deeper type of arrogance in me. I was like, this is pretty cool. I can basically develop what I want. And my social life was wrapped up in Food Network. I mean, I was going out every night to events to learn more about chef. I mean, not every night, but basically my social life was very much connected to being Matthew Stillman Food Network, as opposed to Matthew Stillman, who happens to work at Food Network. And so when the network's ownership changed, the programming direction started to shift. And what sort of seemed like a wide open, cool, fun, possibility-laden world in 97 and 98 and even in a little bit of 99, it started to shift. And I actually was told by some of the higher ups, like, you've done really good stuff, but the network's changing. We're developing. Like, you're part of like the launch, but you know, we have other goals now. And, you know, HGTV is going to be connected to Food Network. And so we need to sort of think about synergy. And I was literally told on more than one occasion, you should just try to be a little bit less creative. And I was like, okay. But in my mind, I was like, screw you. You basically don't, like, I brought this network up on these amazing shows and the other ones I was working on. And I'm the golden boy of Food Network, so whatever. And I just kept on taking the meetings that I wanted to take and developed the things that I wanted to develop. And when my bosses would say, meet with this person, I'd be like, I'll call that person and spend 10 minutes with them, because that's basically pretty lame. And I'll actually spend more time developing the stuff that I want to develop. And when we get to develop meetings, they'd say, all right, show us what you got. And I'd be like, well, you know, here's the thing that I'm working on. Everyone's like, that's great, because these are all smart people who can appreciate good television. And they're like, that's really cool, but what about this thing that you were supposed to be working on? I'm like, oh, it didn't really pan out, and they weren't really that interested, and whatever. And so I was very actively, although I thought I was doing the absolute right thing at the time, totally myopic, totally closed-minded, totally lost perspective. I was working against the direct orders of my superiors and thought that my vision of Food Network was more important than anything. And basically was totally subversive, and I got fired for, I think the official term was insubordination, but I mean, there was a whole raft. I mean, it was totally that's what happened. I mean, I basically worked against my boss's orders for a while. I mean, for a long time, the job was incredibly fun, and all these social parts and developing cool shows was fun. But for the last year that I was there, I didn't even realize how much I wasn't enjoying it. Not because the things I was intrinsically doing were fun, but I was sort of sneaking around, trying to like obfuscate like the time where I was spending my time. So even though I was still doing work and being productive, and even doing the things that they were asking me to do, it really was 80% what I wanted to do and 20% that they were telling me to do. So I got fired. That was totally devastating.
I'll bet.
It was, yeah, totally.
Kind of like a shock. Well, I want to shift gears a little bit. And, you know, just because you were part of the network at such an interesting time, I would love to just kind of get some of your thoughts on the current status of the Food Network. I mean, we kind of connected with you, I think, via Twitter.
Yeah.
Based on some comments that one of our hosts and our founder, Patrick Martins, made at the James Beard Food Conference this past year, where he essentially called the Food Network out and said, you know, look, in your entire history, you've never done a bit of kind of real advocacy work for food. You know, you're not covering the issues important to food production, to farmers, antibiotics in the food supply, slaughterhouses. And I'm just curious, you know, what about that comment struck you and how you would, you know, critique the network today?
I think that comment is right on. I mean, something that I was really interested in doing at the network and pitched it really hard, both when the network was sort of growing and it was cool to make all sorts of wackadoo suggestions, and even when it was in that sort of tight, tough period for me when I was trying to push my own agenda, I really wanted to do politics. I thought that was really absolutely tied up in food, and I wanted to do stuff about hunger, and I wanted to do stuff about production and distribution. I mean, all those things are really critical, and I was thinking about that stuff even then for various other reasons. But the response, which I understand, on a pure business level, but I think from a responsibility level and also from a fullness level, I think it's really important to cover those stories. But the rationale, which I heard then, which I really believe is still the case in the organization, and there's been a tiny touch where they did an issue about childhood hunger in the last year. I think with Jeff Bridges, I think, hosted it. Was we want to make people happy. We want to have people have a good experience with food, and we don't want to assuage guilt. We don't want to give people guilt. We don't want to give people sadness. We don't want to give people fear. We're not doctors, which is why we don't do health shows. We want food to be about celebration and connection and interest and fun. And again, that makes sense, but you know, the Scripps networks, you know, and Food Network is very much connected to HGTV, which is connected to DIY. You know, I think with, you know, home and garden television, you could absolutely do the same sorts of politics about, you know, where does your plastic, you know, wood come from? What does the effect of this have on the environment? What, you know, let's do a comparison. You know, where is your soil coming from? What are the politics of that? Those are all relevant questions. But if they're trying to be a unified, fun, connected network, you know, they'll say, we're not journalists. It's not our job. Our job is to entertain. And I think, you know, my own personal vision for not every network, but for something that has such a explicitly political issue like food, is that I'd rather it be whole than just happy. And I think that in some ways is one of my earlier critiques, is that I want programs that assume viewers are smart. And when I pushed for Iron Chef and Good Eats, I said, I know that there are people who are weird and smart who are interested in finding out about this stuff and living in this world. And there were, and they met them. You know, when Discovery Channel made Mythbusters, which is an amazing show, they essentially made the assumption people are really smart and want to hear about the physics of falling off a building while being wrapped in bubble wrap. They want to see those designs. They are totally interested in that. We assume viewers are smart and will catch up with us or keep up with us. And similarly, I think if you said, here are the politics of poverty, here are the politics of food distribution or animal slaughter or whatever, Some people will be totally sad and bummed out by it. And some people will be like, thank you, I didn't know, or I want to know, or I'm willing to follow you. And it doesn't all need to be done in serious talking head documentary style, though there's nothing wrong with that. There's lots of ways to have roundtable discussions or dips into the subject matter, which are not necessarily, you don't need to see, you know, chickens being beaten to death in, you know, a Tyson's food factory. There are other ways of being informed. But to be able to be unafraid to talk about those things, I think makes you incomplete.
Wow. Matt, thank you so much for joining us. Unfortunately, we are out of time. We have been speaking with Matthew Stillman, who was director of programming at the Food Network back in the late 90s. You have been listening to the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I am your host, Erin Fairbanks. And so stay tuned. Stick with us as we continue to bring you additional special reports and coverage. You can find all of our programs archived at www.heritageradionetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.